This part?
Yeah. Everybody, and welcome back to Don't Quit Your Day Job. That was the inimitable Marky T playing a song that maybe you've heard of. Thanks for coming on the show, Mark, and thanks for showing off your Skynyrd skills.
Thank you for having me. And now I need a dictionary to know what that word means.
So I mean, you know that. What high esteem I regard you in. I'm only going to use big words today.
Okay, great. Let me get my thesaurus out. Am I putting my guitar down?
Yeah, you can put your guitar down now that we've had the treat. Thank you. But you did just recently play like a Southern rock show in LA. So give us the deets. How did it go? Did people clamor for Freebird and you were like, okay, here it is. We're going to play it now.
It seemed apropos, that's for sure. You know, to play all those Southern rock based songs and not play the one that people scream out no matter what concert you're at. I mean, I feel like it would have been wrong. And the funny thing is, none of us in the band had actually, other than the other guitar player, Celso, when he lived, he's from Brazil and he had a Skynyrd tribute band in Brazil. Okay. So he had played all these before, but no one else in the band had. And so for us, it was all like, this is kind of neat playing this song. You know, it felt weird, you know, but I know people wanted to hear it. And, you know, we did all the ones you would expect to hear. We did Flirting with Disaster, and we did Whippin' Post, and we did Midnight Rider, and we did Caught Up in You 38 Special, and Jealous Again, and you know, we had fun playing those songs. It was actually a really good time learning them all.
Is Freebird a hard or easy song to learn? Actually, there's a lot happening, right? There's a lot of guitars.
It's very dynamic. There's a lot of loud and soft parts in it, and the solo is relentless, you know? I mean, I was glad Celso took the main body of the solo because I know it, but I was like, man, I hope my fingers could. It's like 6 minutes of just, you know, I mean, you're moving the whole time. So even the last 2 minutes that I'm hopping on to do the harmony and stuff with him, it's like, hey,
cool.
it's a workout.
And there was an audience for that, is my other question, right? There's an appetite for that sort of music still?
Yeah, we had a good crowd. I mean, I was pleasantly surprised, you know. I wasn't sure what the turnout would be, but no, it was nice enough that the club wants to do it again and they want us back on a weekend, which is great because it has even more of a built-in audience on the weekend. Cool. So we're excited about that.
Cool. I was just reading, speaking of LA and Hollywood, I was just reading about Gazzari's and how it turned into something else. I can't remember the
club. One Oak.
Okay. And was Gazzari's like the thing? I always thought it was the whiskey was the thing back in the day.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, Gazzari's was a cool local spot that did actually help, you know, bands like Van Halen and Guns N' Roses. And, you know, Bill Gazzari, he ran a tight ship, but they had, you know, bands on 7 nights a week, you know, and he was more of a fan of covers and bringing in girls, whereas by the mid-80s, the original stuff was what was really happening. Because when Van Halen was playing Gazzari's, they were playing covers. They weren't playing their original. When they played the Whiskey, they played their original music. When they played the Starwood on that rainy Monday night that Ted Templeman went in there, they were playing original music. But Gazzari's was always expecting you to play covers there. And so in the mid-80s, that kind of change happened with Poison. Bill Gazzari realized, oh, my God, all these girls are, you know, because all he cared about was getting girls in his club, literally. Like, I mean, that was his ads. He'd even say, I have the hottest guys on stage. Come in, you ladies. All pretty ladies are welcome, you know. And he, you know, and the guy's like 90 and he's got like 2 20-year-olds on each arm, you know. And so it was kind of the sleazier of the places for sure.
Right. Did you play there?
I played there a lot. I mean, that was, you know, and again, it was the least of the four big clubs at that point, which would be the Troubadour on parallel from the Sunset Strip, but right on Santa Monica Boulevard. I mean, it, literally, you could walk down there from the Sunset Strip. Okay. We used to do that. And then you have the Whiskey and you have the Roxy, very, you know, classy clubs, basically. And then you had Gazzari's. And Gazzari's was where you pretty much always started off, you know, and you didn't have to pay to play at Gazzari's, whereas the Whiskey, Troub, and Roxy, you had to pay to play as a new band. To play those venues, you know? So like when Mariah moved there, the first show we took was at the Roxy, but I think it cost us like $1,000 to play at like 8 o'clock on a Friday night, you know? Yeah. We thought this is going to make us, you know? And then we're like, okay, well, let's play the Whiskey. So we played like a Thursday night for $600 and that didn't happen. So then we played the Troubadour on like a Tuesday night for $200. That didn't happen. So then we started playing Gazzari's and we hooked up with this guy named Rich Bartle, who's still pretty big inside the business, tour manager, promoter, coordinator. He does all that stuff. But he used to have a thing called the Rich Bartle Sunday Night Jet Set. And it was like his jam night, basically. Mm-hmm. But how it worked was you just bring your guitars and every band can get up there and do three songs and that's it. So we used to go do those. And the band we used to play with all the time was Bite the Bullet, they were called at that point. And then they changed it to South Gang. And it was Butch Walker who ended up becoming pretty famous. So Butch and I were always backstage, like, you know, talking guitar stuff, and then we'd go play. And I was always blown away by him. And he always had – from the time they moved to L.A., I mean, I think – I thought they were going to be huge because every big – I felt lucky playing with them because every big – label, manager, agent would come out to see them. Right. So, you know, I think that's how we ended up with Gene Simmons, you know, because he came to see them, but liked our energy and liked what we were doing and then told us everything we were doing wrong. And that's about it. And Gazzari also, sorry to interrupt Gazzari was also famous for, they had a dance contest, like a wet t-shirt contest. And that was like Sunday nights. And Van Halen played that for a long time. And then I guess he got in trouble with the city for having like wet t-shirt or whatever. So then he just had dance contests. And I remember like going to those and like, if a girl would even so much as grab a glass of water or start to hike her skirt up, they would freak out because they must have gotten fined a lot or something, because it was like, you know, the bouncer would run up and carry her off the stage and everybody be throwing stuff and screaming like, what are you doing?
That is, I remember Gazzari's from The Decline of Western Civilization Part 2 specifically because there's a whole sequence where he does like whatever, some contest, and it's just all girls. And when they interview the girls in that show, I mean, God love them, they're like some of the dumbest people I've ever seen like in front of a camera before.
Well, the girl who won the contest, I'll never forget, she said, they said, so what are you going to do now that you won the contest? She goes, well, I'm going to continue with my career actressing.
Yes, exactly. I distinctly remember that. It's so good. And the segue here is I want to talk a little bit about gear and the importance of gear, but not in the boring here. Let's talk about what pedal board you're using, but in the context of how guitar culture might use that as a weapon, sort of an exclusionary weapon, or you can't be in the circle. And I'm going to talk about dumbbells here in a second. But okay. When back in the day, did you have to have a Marshall, I guess, is my starting question. Because it was in the midst of like the hot rodded Soldano Mesa thing, but it was still very Marshall-y, right?
And let's just say I'm kind of old. And that when I was coming up, I mean, really, you had Fenders and you had Marshalls. Mm-hmm. And then the outlayers were Peavey, Laney, Crate, and you saw Mesa Boogies, but they were very much a boutique amp at that mm-hmm. point. They weren't known as being the high gain. Right. They were like Santana played them at that point. Yeah. So people hadn't really discovered. And but I would say the mark everybody wanted to hit was having a Marshall, you know, a Marshall Stack. I mean, I remember getting my first Marshall Stack. I remember I was like 17. I got a credit card and I was like, I'm going to buy a Stack. And I wanted like the 412 big deal. And they had the brand new mini Stack, which was like 410s and then another 410 cabinet and then like a mini head But I was like, I got a Marshall stack. I don't care. You know, I mean, I came to LA with it, ended up having to sell it to eat. But, you know, it was definitely the benchmark of what you wanted as a guitar player at that era, unless you were playing like the blues. And then you wanted a Fender, or if you were Stevie Ray, you were so innovative that you were playing a Fender and a Marshall.
And ultimately, Stevie was playing a Dumble, which, again, I want to talk about here in a second. But
that's a bit of a misnomer. I mean, he did have a Dumble, but it was owned by Jackson Browne at the studio he did his first record. So he wasn't playing that on the road. That wasn't his Dumble. It just happened to be there and sounded insanely great. What Stevie did was he played a Marshall Town and Country and a Fender Super Reverb, and he bridged them together. So they were both on at the same time. And that's what gave him that wall of sound, because he had a Fender and a Marshall, and he blended them and played them real loud.
And just one more thing, back to the old days with the Marshall. If you didn't have a Marshall, would you feel pressure to not play, for example, or feel pressure to borrow something? Or so I guess my point is, how important is the nameplate, right? Or how important was the nameplate in getting the gigs and doing shows?
I mean, I think it was important to a degree. If you had a good sound out of your PV, no one was going to complain. You know what I mean? But there's definitely the fact that you turn on MTV and every band has Marshall stacks behind them makes you go, okay, that must be, you know, the tool that I need for this job. So I think, you know, people tended to get those just because of what they saw and read in guitar magazines. But I mean, I had a PV at one point and it just didn't sound great. I wasn't embarrassed to play it, you know, but once I tried it I played a few shows with it and I was like, you know what? This thing doesn't sound like a basement. It looks like a basement. So I'm just going to go to a basement because those sound good for my taste. You know, I mean, there's Leonard Skinner was endorsed by PV. They use PV and you can very much hear the sound of it when you see their live setup. The Stones in the 70s used Ampeg guitar amps, which had a very specific and really cool sound, you know, so they weren't feeling any pressure to use a Marshall, you know. But I mean, you look at Motley Crue or Rat or Dokken or Poison or any, you know, Guns N' Roses for that matter, you know. I mean, everybody was playing a Marshall, and what happened was Marshall would just keep hot rodding them more and more, so you get more gain at a lower volume. And I mean, and that's been the fight, is, you know, Eddie Van Halen came along and gave us a sound like nothing else by using a Variac, which basically put less voltage into the amp. You know, if you had 120 watt amp and he put 75 in it, it would at a lower volume get a lot dirtier. And so they figured out ways to actually just put that in the amp without having to use an out external control or anything like that.
Right. So then in the early 90s, Dumble became a thing, particularly with a different set. So not really the crowd you were in, but like Robin Ford, like the super blues thing. I don't know if you're a Robin Ford fan.
I played a show with him.
You did? All right. Let's because he's notoriously prickly. So what's the story?
Well, he was very nice to us. He was very prickly to his band during soundcheck. The drummer was missing stuff and he was drilling the drummer. And I remember like walking out of the soundcheck like, ooh, I feel real bad for that drummer. But he was playing that Dumble and it sounds great. And, you know, I don't find that the Dumble – I find the Dumble is used more in guitar virtuosic world, like guys like Robin Ford. You know, I mean, Stevie is associated with it, but I can't think of, I mean, maybe you know and I don't, but are there metal guys who are known for playing Dumble amps? Or
no,
like,
no, it's very much like the smooth rock thing. I know that like Christopher Cross played a Dumble. He was friends
with
Dumble.
Who's an amazing player, by the way.
Right.
The dude is insane. He's as good a guitar player as he is a singer-songwriter. And I mean, he's got the gold records and Grammys to back it up.
Exactly, right. But Dumble has become this sort of mythical thing, right? So when we talk about gear, it's like, okay, here's a Dumble amp for sale on eBay or on Reverb, and it's $60,000 and, you know, whatever. And it becomes this unobtainium thing, and people want them, even though, I guess here's really the question. I was reading a long forum entry, and basically people were saying, you have to be on a list, right? You have to know someone who knows someone. You have to have been friends with Alexander Dumble. Otherwise, you're not good enough to own a Dumble, which is some of the dumbest take I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I totally agree. And I think Alexander Dumble like built his reputation that way. You know, he knew, hey, if I make 6 amps a year and I sell them for 60 grand, that's going to be a lot better than me trying to pump out, you know, $2,000 amps. And, you know, so he took the road of being a recluse and a weirdo and a legend, you know, for the most part, you know, and he's revered for that. And, you know, you think of it, it's like Dumble amps, Klon pedals, and now the Analog Man pedals with his like 4-year waiting list. It's just insane. You know, I mean, I get it. It is good stuff. I, you know, when the Analog Man came out, all my guitar guys 5, 6, 10 years ago, when it was brand new, they were all buying it and going crazy about it. And it was $200 and you could get it, you know, in 3 months. And now it's, you know, now it's $400 to $600 in a 3-year wait, unless you want to buy it used, and it's $1,000. And it's just, it's not worth it. Buy an amp. Practice.
Yeah. So, well, there's the real thing, right? This is something that you and I talk about whenever we have a lesson, right? I want to take the pill that makes me a better guitar player, or I want to buy the amp that Robin Ford plays, and now I'm going to sound like Robin Ford, right? I think that that's what people, they say they don't think that way, but they definitely think that way.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm a Randy Rhoads fan. The first pedal I bought was an MXR Distortion Plus. Why? Because Guitar Magazine said Randy Rhoads plays an MXR Distortion Plus, and I wanted that sound, you know? And the funny thing is I just plugged it in the other day messing around with some Randy stuff, and I was like, that pedal really does have that little thing of his sound. Like, I can hear where his tone is. Now, when I play it, do I sound like him? No, but I can emulate the tone a bit, and I can play some of the rhythm stuff and go, wow, I hear it now, you know? And to be honest, Paul, it's funny we're talking about pedals, because doing that Southern Rock show the other night, I brought my Vibra King amp, which is a really, really loud amp, which has to be played loud in order to sound good. And I didn't even get it on one. Like, literally, I turned it so sound came out of it, and the sound guy goes, whoa, you got to turn that thing down. And I'm like, great. And I didn't prepare for that, because I only brought my Tumnus pedal. So I put the gain on 10 and I tried to turn up the Tumnus pedal, and I still could not get any oomph out of it. You know, like, it sounded fine, but it was just clean. So trying to play some of those tunes, like the Black Crowes ones, there was no distortion on it. Like, I saw some of the video and it like kind of bums me out, because it sounds clean. It sounds great. It's there's the complaint is that it needed some more distortion to sound more authentic. Like, it wasn't like I go, oh, okay, I played all that stuff okay, you know? So I, being a crazy pedal guy like you, I have, you know, looking in front of me, I have 12 gain pedals down there. And that's not including a little road case I have that I know I have. So now I got to figure out how to stay at a low volume and figure out which pedal is going to give me enough gain at a low volume, which some people are telling me to get a heavy metal pedal, which is funny, because like, you wouldn't think heavy metal pedal will work for the blues, but it might give me just a bit of distortion at a low volume, which is what I need right now. So I'm really struggling.
Isn't that a common thing for you, where you go and do something, play something, and you don't have enough gain? I've heard a similar story more than once.
I get accused of not enough gain all time. And I will say, the other night was the first time I heard it and said, ooh, like, that is way – but I felt it while I was playing. Right, I felt like, man, I'm not getting that grit. Usually there's a little extra sustain, a little extra dirt on it, so to speak. And it's like, no matter what I did, and I like got the distortion on 10 on the Tumnus. And usually that works good, but it works good when I can crank my amp up and then control it with the pedal. But this was the first time I ran into the fact that, like, I was so bummed. I'm like, I barely even, like, literally, I went from off to just a little noise. And he's like, that's too much. And I told him, I'm like, I can't turn down, because off is the next number. And he goes, well, we'll work with it, you know. And I'm like, great, you know. And I could tell, like, the first solo I played in soundcheck, I'm like, I don't have enough gain, but I don't have time to go home or go to a music store and get it. So
just get a little pedal, yeah.
To figure it out.
One last thing on Dumbles, or, for example, I know you're a Les Paul guy, 59 Les Paul, right? The archetype of all Les Pauls that everybody wants. Are these things that you ever wanted? Did you want ever in your career something that everyone talked about that was in very low supply, but you felt like if you had it, it could make a difference for you?
I've always wanted a 59, like even like an R9 or an R8. I think I've told you this before. Les Pauls are my ultimate favorite guitar, but I'm not a huge fan of the arch that they have in the top. And the 58s and 59 have a flat top, and it just, my hand feels so much better in that. And so I've pined for it my whole life, and I'll probably never have one, and I probably just will deal with it because my George Lopez Les Paul is the it plays and feels great. Like I don't know that I can get a guitar that'll play and feel better than that, even though I know physically I like the way a 59 would feel.
Then going along with that, Mike Fuller, who's a pedal manufacturer, notoriously prickly, even terrible, a million stories of terrible customer service, just being like, hey, I bought this pedal, it doesn't work, and then him accusing you of being an idiot with wooden ears, right, that wouldn't know how to play. You shouldn't be playing one of his pedals because you're not good enough. So there's that. And then there's some sort of unpleasant, some would argue racist remarks with regards to the riots and things. And then he shut down his company, and his used market sort of went up. And now he's opened shop again. Yep. And okay, if he says stuff and you don't like him, you don't support him, right? No one's canceling him. You're just choosing where to spend your dollar. And I think that that's fine.
Exactly. Yeah.
But that brought me to the question, can you separate art from the artist? Is there someone who you think, this is probably legitimately a terrible person, but I still dig the music that they make, or the pedal does a thing that no other pedal does, and so I still want it?
Not really. No, I mean, I think the closest I can come is I can stand some Ted Nugent songs. some Ted Nugent songs are definitely earworms, you know, and I've heard since a kid, and I hate everything about his politics, but sometimes I can just put it aside and go Cat Scratch Fever.
All right, cool. Then we're going to leave Mike Fuller alone because he's not worth our attention, actually.
Agreed.
So the last thing I want to talk to you about here is the idea from, let's be uncharitable and call it a boomer. A boomer wrote on a forum that guitar players don't get any respect anymore, right? It's everything is really hard, and all these kids on YouTube can play so much better, and it's really hard for a normal working guitar player to be respected. And it's just like, what are you talking about?
Right. I mean, it sounds like somebody just hasn't had any success, so they're just like, you know, taking it out on people who are talented and know how to put themselves out there. You know, I mean, the thing is like, I talk to other guitar players all the time, and we're always like floored by those Instagram guitar kids or YouTube guitar kids, but can they get on the bandstand? Can they jam? Can they sit in and play a song perfectly through and or put their own stamp on it? Because technically, they're doing some crazy great stuff.
Right.
But there's more to being a musician than just, you know, painting by numbers. So that's my only thing with all of that. And again, there's plenty of them that I'm talking about that obviously can get on stage and do some sick stuff. There are some young guitar players that are so amazing right now. I my jaw drops just hearing them.
So this got me thinking about the idea that we've also talked about before. It's not really that the guitar doesn't have the respect, because that's just the notion in and of itself is silly, right? But the skill set of being a shredder, right? The idea of the shredder from the 80s, like that was the thing. I remember being in high school and college and be like, man, I want to be a shredder. If I can't play as fast as Jimmy Bell or whoever, then, you know, I shouldn't be playing guitar. And then you get over it because, of course, I'll never be able to play as fast as Jimmy Bell, right? And it's not even just as fast, it's as good as Jimmy Bell. Jimmy Bell's a very good guitar player, right?
Right. Yeah.
And so you learn to do your own thing. But the important thing is it's not playing in a vacuum, which is what I think we're talking about here. If you're on YouTube and you're just playing to a camera, you don't have the idea of playing with other people and listening to what's happening, which is maybe arguably something that we are losing. Do you think the idea of live music is, or that collaboration is going away in any way?
I think a bit. Yeah. You know, I mean, and we're getting older, you know, and when we were younger, we liked different types of music and we liked different approaches to music and we liked what our peers were doing, you know what I mean? So it's like, I just try to have a part of me say, you know, I don't want to be that cranky old guy, like, you kids and your new music, because some of it is great, you know, and it's just different, that's all. But I'll give you an example. You know, the other night when we did that Southern Rock tribute, we had one rehearsal and we couldn't even get through all the songs because we just didn't have enough time.
Because they're all 15 minutes long.
Well, no, and we cut a lot of them, but we just wanted to work on endings and harmonies, you know, like little specific parts of songs. So we didn't get through them all. We did the show, and I can't tell you, Paul, how many people came up and said, that is the tightest band I've ever seen. You guys are – and even the drummer admittedly didn't even have time to learn the songs. Like, he was charting them before we went on stage, relying on our cues. That's how good he was. But he listened, and that's what I – you know, the fans were saying, oh, you guys are so tight and so good, and I go – we just listen to each other. We're good musicians who pay attention. And that's what you're supposed to do. Like, if the dude's playing a solo and I just start playing rhythm louder than he's playing a solo, that's not making the song better, right. You know, and that's not making me look cooler, you know. But when you're younger, you think you got to be louder, you got to be more brash, you got to, you know, make it all about you. But it's like, when you get good musicians, they all make it about the song. And that was the really cool feature of doing that, was like, everybody really was cognizant of every little aspect of the song. And because there's a lot of intricacies in those songs, especially when you're trying to learn them, you know, I mean, you can laugh and go, Flirting with Disaster is nothing, you know, it's three little parts, but it's not. There's all these little like riffs that are in there, and hits where they're all playing together, and, you know, harmonies that are in there, guitar harmonies that are in there. So it's like, I thought, I'll be honest, when I listened to the song, because I had never even listened to Molly Hatchet before, when I listened to it, the first time I heard it, I was like, this is going to be a hard one for us to play. And, you know, the more I played along with it, the more I was like, okay, it's in my wheelhouse. I get all these. But when I was listening to it, I was like, man, that is a piece of like Mozart, you know, like there's all these little intricacies in there. And I'm going to try to not say that word ever again, because it just doesn't come out. It's very intricate.
When you're doing lessons, right, the focus is on guitar playing, right? That's what you're doing as a teacher. I'm coming to you and I'm saying, okay, I want to learn this bit. Or if it's a kid, maybe they say, okay, I want to learn this Green Day song. Teach me this Green Day song, because I want to be able to play along to it. How does someone learn to play with other people? Is it just by experience? Is that really the only way to do it?
The only way to do it is to do it, yeah. I mean, you can warm yourself up playing with jam-along tracks, especially if those jam-along tracks just aren't a loop. You know, the problem is when you get the jam-along tracks that are just the same 12 bars over and over again, because there's no dynamics there. But there's like the Now You Shred guy on YouTube. His part, he has parts in the songs, and he always puts the chords up at the same time the video's going, and some of those parts are, you know, lower in volume or raised in intensity. So that's how you should be playing when you're interacting with other players. So that'll give you a little help in the beginning, but really you just need to do it, you know? And I know it's always intimidating playing with other players. I mean, I can remember my first jam sessions. I can remember like shaking, picking up the guitar, going like, oh my God, I'm going to play with somebody else. Like, this is like, they're going to be great. And I don't know what to do. I'm going to go blank, you know? Cause that's what happens, you know?
The other thing with guitar playing and playing with other people is tone, right? I think also a missing ingredient here is, this sounds amazing in my room, but it's all highs and lows and there's no mids, and guitars are a mid instrument. And then I go play with a drummer and there's cymbals and a kick drum, and now there's a bass player. Now I can't hear myself. So now I'm in a volume war. I'm going to turn everything up because I haven't dialed it in right. But I have tried to have that conversation with people. It's like, the sound you hear in your bedroom is not the sound you want on stage, but people don't want to hear that. And I'm not sure how to get that point across.
That's a hard one to teach, you know? I mean, and until you start listening back to yourself recorded live, you don't learn the little trick. So what I do, like with Little Caesar or Cruzados when we're on the road, is we get into a new room and while drummer setting up, I make sure I plug in and I play a little. I see what the room bounces off like. I see what everything sounds like. Am I too bright? Am I too bassy? Am I too mids? And then I put the guitar down and I walk away and I wait until the bass and drums and Lauren are playing. And once they start playing, then I go right to my mids and I hit it and I go, oop, I'm cutting right there. Okay. Yeah. And right when I can hit, then I know I don't need to use my volume. It's just about finding the frequency that my guitar projects through.
Right.
And that was a long time coming to learn that lesson. You know, I didn't know because I was too busy playing and turning up, because that's right. What you do. You go, I can't hear myself. I turn up. You don't realize you have, you know, treble, mid and bass, and some amps even have more frequencies than that, you know, but like just having that little scoop right there, I can find a spot now where I can hear myself.
Yeah. It's funny the things we learn as we get older, right?
Mm-hmm.
If only we knew them back then.
Man, la la, just like the song, you know, I wish I knew what I knew then. I wish I knew now what I know then.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Right on. Well, I want to thank everyone who's listening and supporting the podcast. As always, it is very much appreciated. Mark has some shows coming up with Little Caesar later in the year in Ohio, and we'll talk about why Ohio, perhaps, in a future episode of all places. But Little Caesar will be on the road. I'll drop links as I always do. Mark, thanks for coming on the show.
Paulie Ann, thank you so much. Favorite podcaster in the country. Thank you.